Imagine a music appreciation class in third grade. The teacher asks you to draw a picture of the images the music is creating in your mind. Chances are you're listening to a tone poem. I asked WRTI's Dave Conant to describe a tone poem, starting with the one Disney conjured up using the apprentice, Yen Sid.
Well, there's music involved, first of all. A tone poem or a symphonic poem, well, it tells a story. It can follow the exact line of a piece of literature or a poem, like The Sorcerer's Apprentice by Paul Dukas, based on a poem by Goethe. It begins as the sorcerer leaves, gives his assistant a chore to take care of. The assistant doesn't like carrying water, so he looks in a book and finds a spell and makes a broom carry the water for him.
A little bit of knowledge in the hands of the apprentice becomes a dangerous thing, and chaos ensues.
It sounded like Liszt was sort of the pioneer of the tone poem.
Certainly came up with the name, yeah, and the idea. Hunnenschlacht is a great one. Have you heard that one?
No.
The Battle of the Huns. He got that from looking at a mural of Romans and the barbarians fighting outside of Rome, and the battle was so ferocious that the combatants continued fighting in the sky after their death. It's a really energetic piece of music.
Sometimes a tone poem takes a listener on a journey.
Smetana's symphonic cycle, Mon Blast, contains probably one of the best constructed ones, the Moldau, which is the German word for the Vltava River that goes through the Czech countryside. And it is a journey. The two small streams flow together, become the Vltava, goes through the countryside. You hear a country wedding being held on the bank of the river as it winds its way through the city of Prague and into the Elbe. It's a beautiful piece of music.
You might enjoy the tone poem more if you know the story or the theme, but it's not really crucial to the experience.
One of the things that people will say is, I don't really know much about classical music. And the answer to that is the same as the answer to the tone poem. If you like it, that's all you need to know.
Log on to WRTI.org to hear all three parts of this classical feature about the music. I'm Meredy Duddleston. WRTI News. This week on News and Views, some musical notes, classical post-its for novices like me. The tempo or pace of a piece can change everything, and that's the artistry, the conductor's vision of how a work should sound. I asked WRTI's Joe Pasternak to put timing in context.
Conductors do take liberties, and they call it interpretation, but essentially, I think when a thing is played at a certain tempo for years and years and years, and you're talking about decades, and then all of a sudden someone says, I'm going to take this a little faster, or I'm going to take this a little slower, it does change the feel of the music.
What you've been hearing is the first movement of Russian composer Dmitri Shostakovich's Symphony No. 5, conducted by his son Maxim. Here's the same movement, faster, under the baton of Leonard Bernstein.
Conductors are also recognized by how they interpret the music.
Beethoven is thought to be the first composer who actually gave directions on tempo, with metronome markings or tables.
Norrington is a perfect example.
This is Roger Norrington's interpretation of a little part of the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth.
When Beethoven drew up his metronome table for the first eight symphonies, he had been able to hear them all.
And here it is with Osmo Vanska conducting the Minnesota Orchestra.
A lot of times it's fashion. Just like when there was a resurgence of the music of Vivaldi in the 50s, all of a sudden it became the thing, and it was in coffee houses, it was everywhere else. There's fashion in music.
Curious about classical music? Log on to WRTI.org to hear all three parts of this week's feature. Next time, WRTI's Jack Moore and a slice of pizzicato. I'm Meredy Duddleston, WRTI News. Remember that? It's the theme from the Red Skeleton Show. That welcome rush of notes was a string technique called pizzicato. You hear it in a classical context with violins, violas, and cellos here on WRTI. Classical host Jack Moore explains.
What's being done when you hear pizzicato is a string player will be holding their instrument and they will put their bow in their hand a certain way so that they can use their right index finger and actually pluck the string. I suppose one of the most famous orchestral pieces for pizzicato is Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony, because in that, the whole third movement is nothing but pizzicato. The string players, if you watch them, they'll put their bow in their lap because they don't play with it at all during that whole movement.
This week on News and Views, classical audio sketches starting with pizzicato, roughly translated from Italian as pluck. It's a technique first noted in a musical score by an Italian composer.
It was an opera composer by the name of Claudio Monteverdi, who, it was around 1638, wrote an opera called Il Combattimento di Tancredi, and he asked the string players to use two fingers of their right hands to really rapidly pluck the strings. He thought it would be a good idea, and it caught on.
Pizzicato can be used like a punctuation mark, or the main event. Left-handed pizzicato is harder to do than right-handed, and not all pizzicato sounds the same. More contemporary composers want a string to snap, almost with a metallic sound.
And this is snap pizzicato. Sometimes it's called Bartok pizzicato because Béla Bartok, the Hungarian composer, used it in a lot of his works. Not only are you plucking it, but you've pulled it so hard that it snaps back against the fingerboard of the instrument. It makes a really percussive sound.
So there you have it, a little bit about pizzicato. To listen to all three parts of this News and Views on what you hear on WRTI, go to WRTI.org. Next time, Dave Conant and the Tone Poem. I'm Meredith Duddleston, WRTI News.